Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Am I tough enough?
Strong and stable leadership.
Total rhubarb.
Hell yes, I'm tough enough.
Shut the fridge.
Not another one.
It's the Politics Show cast.
My name is Norm Finkelstein, and I've studied the Israel-Palestine conflict since long before you were born, and maybe even your father was born. I started in 1982. When Israel invaded Lebanon, and I've persisted the past four decades and more. And for the past 15 years, my focus has been Gaza, and I'm the world's leading authority on Gaza, but by virtue of the fact that there isn't anybody else. So it's a very low bar to be the world's leading authority.
A world-leading authority in a field of one, which I guess also makes you the least authoritative figure as well as the most.
You hit all the nails on the head. You're obviously British because you're much cleverer with words than Americans.
No, I wouldn't go that far. Norm, we'll just get straight into it. I mean, we the media, and I use that collectively, often talk about the current events in Israel and Palestine as beginning on October 7th. But of course, there is a much longer history, much greater context within which those attacks took place. So I just invite you to tell us really about the situation in Palestine, particularly in Gaza, before October 7th, and provide us with a little bit of that context that perhaps has been lacking in the conversation so far.
Well, it's always hard to know where to begin, because where you begin is already taking a political stand. So unlike my Jewish landsmen, I'm not going to start 3,000 years ago. I'm going to give your audience a break, and I'll start with the first Arab-Israeli war, which seems to me a reasonable place to begin, because that's when Gaza became Gaza. In the course of the first Arab-Israeli war, about 300,000 Palestinian Arabs were expelled from the area that became Israel, and they ended up in Gaza. And now they constitute, as of now, they and their descendants from 1948, they constitute roughly 80% of Gaza's population. So when we think about Gaza, we should remember or bear in mind as a point of departure that A, it's an overwhelmingly refugee population, refugees from 1948 and their descendants. And B, it's an overwhelmingly child population. Gaza's 50% children, classified, you know, under international standards as a child. And that to me is a very important point to bear in mind, Just before I came on with you, I downloaded the latest report from B'Tselem. B'Tselem is the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. And they just issued a new report, the title of which is The State of Hunger in the Gaza Strip in Recent Months. And its conclusion, stated at the very outset, is, let me just get it for you. Israel is committing the war crime of starvation in the Gaza Strip. So let me just hold it up for you. It's the Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem. Israel is committing the war crime of starvation in the Gaza Strip. And when we talk about what's called a man-made or human-made famine in Gaza, we have to bear in mind that half the victims of this famine, half are children. When you look at images, I don't watch digital media on Gaza or even October 7th because I find it really unbearable. But when even you see the photographs from Gaza, however arbitrary these photographs are, they're always overwhelmed with children. It is children who are being starved to death now in Gaza. So those to me are the two points of departure. Overwhelmingly a refugee population, a majority child population. Now, already from early on, the people, the expellees from Israel who ended up in Gaza, they were unwilling to acquiesce in their fate. And so what you have from 1949 onwards is a sequence of massacres committed against the people of Gaza, who, as I said, were unwilling to acquiesce in the fate that Israel had meted out to them. So if you look at, for example, Benny Morris's Border Wars, he's an Israeli historian. He says from 1949 to roughly 1953, Israel killed up to 5,000 Palestinian refugees, both in the West Bank and in Gaza, who sought to return to their homes, to their fields, to their families, to their neighbors. And Morris writes, 90% of them were unarmed. These were not terrorists. These were people who had been extirpated from their homes and were trying to go back to see their fields, their families, and so forth. In 1956, when Israel invades the Sinai in collusion with the UK, your country, and France, Israel entered Rafah city, entered Khan Yunis city, lined up, and shot down dead hundreds of Palestinian men. Without trial, without any process, forget about due process, just line them up and shot them dead. You come to 1967 when Israel occupies Gaza in the course of the 1967 war. And now the Israelis are again determined to suppress, repress any Palestinian resistance in Gaza to the occupation. And under then chief of the Israeli Southern Command, Ariel Sharon, under Ariel Sharon, they commit new massacres in Gaza. The first intifada, which you are too young to remember, but which I witnessed firsthand because I was in the West Bank and for occasion in Gaza, begins in 1987 in Jabalia refugee camp in Gaza. It's an overwhelmingly nonviolent civil resistance by all accounts, including my own personal account because I was there. It's an overwhelmingly nonviolent civil resistance, the first intifada. Israel engages in massive brutality to repress it. By 1991, Israel institutes in Gaza what it called the closure policy. And closure is just a euphemism for beginning in 1991, Israel starts to seal off Gaza from the rest of the world. By 2004, 2003, very mainstream Israeli figures, you take Baruch Kimmerling from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He's a senior a professor there. He describes Gaza as, quote, the largest concentration camp ever. Or you take Giora Eiland, who at the time was the head of Israel's National Security Council. And as far as any human being could be from a leftist and very close to a lunatic rightist. And Giora Eiland very casually observes that Gaza is, quote, a huge concentration camp. In 2006, Hamas comes into power. It's elected in a democratic election. Immediately as it comes into power, Israel imposes this brutal economic siege of Gaza, which is then seconded by the US and the EU. And basically it meant that no one can go in and no one can leave without Israeli permission. And few and far between were those who could leave. According to the South African application to the International Court of Justice, the genocide application, they report that over 300, close to 400 Gazans died because they were unable to leave Gaza in order to obtain better medical treatment. So nobody can go out, nobody can go in, nothing can go out, nothing can go in. At a certain point, Israel was keeping Gaza on what they called a humanitarian minimum diet, which is a euphemism for a starvation plus diet. And they banned chocolate from going into Gaza. They banned potato chips from going into Gaza. They banned notebooks from going into Gaza. They banned musical instruments from going into Gaza. They banned children's toys from going into Gaza. They banned any spices from going into Gaza. And they had a policy, a calculated policy of keeping Gaza just on the brink of economic catastrophe, just on the precipice of economic catastrophe. And then if you fast forward to the night before October 7th, by that point, 50% of Gazans were unemployed, 60% of youth were unemployed, 50% were classified as food insecure, 80% were living off of government doles, government charity. That was Gaza. Now, there are two other facts that need to be brought into the picture. I have left out in my description so far that periodically Israel went into Gaza to quote unquote mow the lawn. And mow the lawn was the expression the Israelis coined for these periodic high-tech massacres in Gaza. The best known being Operation Cast Lead in 2008-9, Operation Pillar of Defense in 2012, Operation Protective Edge in July, August 2014. And in each of these massacres, hundreds and sometimes thousands of Palestinians in Gaza were killed. Hundreds of children were killed. In Cast-Lead, it was 350. In Protective Edge, it was 550 children. And then thousands and thousands and thousands of homes were pulverized, leveled, systematically, methodically, with no armed conflict in play. Just neighborhood after neighborhood was roped off. It's all described in Israeli soldier testimonies, roped off and demolished. They brought in the bulldozers and demolished thousands and thousands of homes. Bear in mind, 80% are refugees and children of refugees. And now their homes, and what they managed to build in those 50 or so years since 1948, the 48 war, and now their homes are demolished. And it's important, I feel, in my opinion, to keep in mind the language. What is mow the lawn? It's taking in an implement with blades on it to mow the lawn. But brace yourself, 50% of the blades in Gaza are children. You're taking blades to crack the skulls of children. That's the metaphor. And that, to me, at the risk of sounding emotive and hyperbolic, that to me is testament to the satanic nature of that state. To coin a phrase like mow the lawn in a population that's half children. And it's precisely that kind of language that enabled the horrors that we have seen unfold since October 7th. So, if you've read, I don't say this proudly, but I do say it as a factual matter. I read the hundreds and hundreds of human rights reports on what has been done to the people of Gaza. And I could tell you with certainty the quantity of the death and destruction that we're now observing has vastly increased. The scale is just totally on a different level, but not the quality. The targeting of children, the targeting of medics, the targeting of hospitals, the using of civilians as human shields, the targeting of journalists, that's all old hat in Gaza. That's par for the course in Gaza. So there's nothing in terms of quality. There's nothing new under the sun. What has changed is this. Up until October 7th, Israel mowed the lawn in Gaza periodically. That is to say, wanted to inflict a high-tech massacre on the people of Gaza to remind them who's in charge. Since October 7th, they modified their strategy. Now, they don't want to mow the lawn, they want to extirpate. That's the fancy word for pull out by its roots. They want to extirpate all the blades of grass in Gaza. They want to, as they've said on many occasions, they want to render Gaza uninhabitable, unlivable, turn it into a howling wilderness. And the only last aspect, I said there were two things I left out in my description. The one I want to leave on is many people are appalled by what happened on October 7th. And there can't be any doubt that atrocities on a significant scale were committed by Hamas. About that, I don't think there is grounds for dispute as of now. You never know what future evidence will bring forth, but as of now, I think that's the reasonable conclusion. What I find troubling is people are expected to answer the question, do you condemn what Hamas did on October 7th? But there is an antecedent question, a question that comes before that, because the question then becomes, well, what did you expect Israel to do after October 7th? These atrocities on a colossal scale, no question in my mind about that. And then the question becomes, what did you expect Israel to do? But I have I think there's an antecedent question. What did you expect the people of Gaza to do, confined in a concentration camp for two decades and more? You might say, well, why didn't they try diplomacy? But they did. When Hamas came into power, it was clearly gesturing towards supporting the two-state settlement along the lines of the international legal consensus for resolving the conflict, legal and political consensus. Israel wouldn't even entertain the notion of negotiations with Hamas. Then in March 2018, in part, I will confess it, in part on my advice, my counsel, I had been in touch with some people there, and I had urged and encouraged try nonviolent civil resistance. Do what, you know, the cliche, do what Gandhi did, do what Martin Luther King did. What happened? They tried it. The Great March of Return began March 30th, 2018. It was overwhelmingly nonviolent. It was a very festive event. They came to the Gaza perimeter fence. They had circus acts. They had music. They had dance. They had celebration amidst the horrors. What did Israel do? We know exactly what they did. They lined up along the perimeter with Gaza. They lined up their best snipers. And what did the snipers do? Amidst this overwhelmingly nonviolent festive occasion, according to a 250-page single-spaced UN report by very prominent jurists from around the world, they targeted children. That's not my words. That's the UN report. They targeted medics, they targeted journalists, and here's the best one of all, because it's so hard to believe. You just don't, your whole being resists believing it. They targeted disabled people. They targeted double amputees. They targeted Gazans on crutches, who were 300 meters away from the perimeter fence, leaning against trees, picnicking. That's who they targeted. And when they didn't kill them, They targeted them because this is their best snipers. This was shooting fish in a barrel. It was. This is not the fog of war. This was shooting fish in a barrel. They targeted the demonstrators from the kneecap down to inflict, to use the technical language, life-changing injuries. Non-technical language, to paralyze them for life. That's what happened. They tried diplomacy, failed. They tried nonviolent civil resistance, failed. So by October 6th, the fate that was awaiting them. How old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 30 years old, Norm.
Okay. For most of those young people who burst the gates of Gaza on October 7th, they were in their early 20s. Probably, I would speculate, but I think my speculation is informed. Probably not married, don't yet have a family, and are young, because most of them recognized it was a suicide mission. The assumption was they're not coming back. You know, once you cross that barrier into Israel, they didn't expect it was going to be that easy. They were very surprised by what happened. They expected it would be killed, you know? So if you had a family already, or if you had children already, if you had married already, you're married already, you wouldn't have volunteered for the mission. Because the guys, the Hamas army, they say 30,000. I don't know. I don't believe a number, Israel says, because all their numbers are fake. But let's call it 30,000. So about 3,000 people, 2,000 to 3,000 is estimated, penetrated the fence. You would guess it was the younger guys, okay? For all of those younger guys, and I think you have to bear it in mind, you're a 30-year-old. You still have your life ahead of you. And all they had no past. They had no present. They were born in the concentration camp. And they had no future. All they had was the expectation to languish and die in this concentration camp. That's all they had.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
It's the Politics Show. Cast.
It's really interesting to hear you make that point and set it out in that contextual setting, because I think really the nub of the question that I, by asking you that, is whether or not there is ever justification for political violence. I feel like that's essentially where we're at. We're talking about an escalation in a series of provocations, whether it's the high-tech massacres that you describe, whether it's that sort of deeply dehumanizing past, present, future lack of, that really the reality of this is that we're ending up in a place where we're talking about, is armed resistance justified? And I feel like particularly here in the UK, there's kind of a, well, it's actually almost a double standard, to be honest with you, that we say no, you know, no. The actions of October 7th were terrorism. There is no justification for them whatsoever, the killing of innocent people. And whether it's, and we sort of stick our fingers in our ears and say, you know, that you can't be violent. You have to adopt the sort of civil resistance, non-violent action. in complete denial of the fact that the state meets out violence every single day, whether it's by the police, her armed forces, or whatever. And I don't know why there's this almost obfuscation or denial of the fact that in the instance of the Palestinian people who have been occupied and face everything that you've just described in that setting, that their violent, I would say sort of morally reprehensible, some of the things that happened on October 7th, that there is actually almost in a way, after listening to the very compelling arguments that you've just made, well, the history that you've just given, you're essentially saying, well, they've exhausted all their other options. Where else should they turn?
Yes, I do believe they exhausted all their options. I want to just, if you allow me, to make a simple comparison, which I think is valid, even as it's simple. In our own country, where here I refer to the United States, before the Civil War, there were slave uprisings, slave rebellions. And those slave uprisings were not a pretty picture. If you take the most famous was by a fellow named Nat Turner. And Nat Turner, in 1831, he went on what you would call nowadays a rampage with his Confederates, a handful of people really, his Confederates. And they killed men. His order, incidentally, Nat Turner's order was kill all white people. That was his order. And they proceeded to do that. Now, in their case, they beheaded babies. That didn't happen in Gaza, but in the case of Nat Turner, it did. They went into bedrooms, took out the axes, and beheaded babies. And it was an interesting revelation for me. I was curious what the abolitionists had to say. The abolitionists were white people who opposed slavery in a very brave fashion. It wasn't an easy thing to do back then. People like William Lloyd Garrison, and there are many others. But I mentioned Garrison because he was the editor of a publication called The Liberator. And he had to contend with what Nat Turner did. And he, as all abolitionists, were like, as you said a moment ago, they were committed to nonviolence. They were committed to what they called moral suasion, trying to convince their fellow citizens, white citizens, that slavery is wrong on moral grounds and try to persuade them. Now, after the Nat Turner Rebellion, Nat Turner and his Confederates, they killed about 61 people in gruesome ways, smashed skulls, beheaded babies. It went the whole nine yards. He said, yes, horrors occurred. The Nat Turner Rebellion, horrors occurred, no question about it. But then when he had to allocate responsibility, allocate blame, he did not blame Nat Turner. He began his editorial and he kept repeating, we told you so. He's speaking to fellow whites. We told you so. We told you so. You treat these people that way, and that's, you know, you're going to reap what you have sown. And I felt his moral posture was correct. You condemned the deed, but he would not condemn the perpetrators because he understood. Remember, we're talking about 1831. Where the prospect of ending slavery was zero in the United States. And Nat Turner, he happened to have been a very smart guy, very smart guy. White said it, black said it. Nat is a very smart guy, okay? He was literate. He knew the Bible like the back of his hand. And what do you think Nat Turner is thinking? He's thinking, and we know he was thinking, I have so much potential as a human being. There are so many dreams I could realize, so many aspirations as a human being that I harbor, but I will never realize those dreams. I will never realize those aspirations. I was born, I'm living, and I will die a slave. And he ultimately rebelled in gruesome ways, for sure. He rebelled at that prospect. And I don't believe there's a substantive difference between his condition and the condition that had been meted out by Israel to the people of Gaza. And so even as I recognize, like the abolitionists, that horrors occurred, I, for one, maybe because I'm too close to the facts, I know in every detail what had been done to the people of Gaza before October 7th. I'm too close to it. My innards writhe each time I read another human rights report. I squint and flinch when I think targeting amputees. This country is completely mad. It's lunatic. And this is not after October 7th. I'm talking about March 2018. Their hatred, their loathing, their contempt for these Palestinians. It's like, you know, when I was a kid, I don't claim to be a saint. I'm not. I'm very far from it. If you knew my flaws, they would frighten and terrify you. I remember as a kid, one of the games we used to play, listen to me, we took what was called a magnifying glass. They were much more popular back then. It's the glass that bends the light into a beam. And our fun was to take the magnifying glass, bend the light to burn to a crisp ants. That was what kids did. They burned to a crisp ants, and it was fun watching the anthills, you know, just implode from the pressure of the light beam. And that's the Israelis with the Palestinians. The fun of targeting amputees. It's the truth. That's why when everybody now is shocked by the videos of the Israelis posting as they incinerate houses or kill Palestinians, and how joyful they are and how euphoric they are, I'm not surprised at all. That's Norm, what I've been reading for 15 years.
Yeah. Norm, can I ask, I mean, there's a couple of words you've used over the course so far of this conversation. You've called the Israeli government satanic, lunatic, which I know as well, it's a reference to a piece you recently published on your Substack, Samson and Cassandra, where you sort of made that argument. You know, another piece you recently wrote on there, when it's okay to nuke a country, and sort of, I think we'll talk about Iran slightly later on, so I'll just leave that for a second. But, you know, I would just say those descriptions, those acts, you know, when it's okay to nuke a country, saying that it's satanic, saying that it's a lunatic nation, I know it's a slightly clumsy comparison to make, the one that I'm about to, but, you know, you are Jewish, your parents were in concentration camps, and I wonder if you worry about sort of the fact that the impact, I should say, that rhetoric like that can have, whether it's about, you know, fueling a rise in anti-Semitism or opening a door for people to be anti-Semitic in their criticism. I just wonder if how you've rationalized those two things with particularly the sort of, yes, the language that you're using to talk about the state of Israel.
Well, look, Ali, I'll treat you as somebody I know and not try to put on an air and estrange one from the other. I'll give you an honest answer. I would say there was a point in my life where my self-identification as Jewish would have caused me to hesitate before uttering statements or descriptives of the kind I just did. But, and I'm here, I'm speaking with complete candor, and I think with utter sincerity. And I know what I'm about to say will probably surprise you. I don't see Israel as a Jewish state. It's a type. The Israeli type is not the type I grew up with as a Jew. As a Jew growing up, being Jewish meant being cerebral. Yes, it meant being cerebral. We took great pride. Can you imagine the pride Jews took in the fact that the four great figures of the modern world, Einstein, Freud, Marx, and some would include Jesus, were Jewish? We surged with pride at that fact. Do you know the kind of pride we took that 25% of the Nobel laureates are Jewish, even though they represent 0.000002% of the world population? Yes, the life of the mind loomed large being Jewish. It also meant being creative, and creative also with a kind of shlemiel. It's hard to translate shlemiel. It means kind of weakling aspect. So for us, a Jew meant Woody Allen. It did for us growing up. Or Franz Kafka with the big ears. You know, that was being a Jew. Lining up along a perimeter fence and targeting double amputees, sorry, that has nothing to do with a Jew or Jews as I grew up understanding that notion. So I don't feel Israel as a Jewish state. I don't. I think it's a lunatic state. So it doesn't, at this point in my life, I don't feel the kind of conflict that you, personal conflict that you allude to. However, I do recognize that Israel calling itself a Jewish state and carrying on as it does is going to increase the danger of anti-Semitism. But that's a problem, in my opinion, first of all, created by the state of Israel. I would much rather it not call itself, you know, Israel, the nation state of the Jewish people. I would rather call itself Israel, the nation state of the lunatic people, or meshuggah. We have in Yiddish the expression meshuggah, which means crazy. So the nation state of the meshuggah people, that would, I think, diminish the prospects of anti-Semitism increasing as Israel carries on. And then the other side is, fortunately, we have reached a point where a large number of Jews have, to use an expression I heard a few months ago, have checked out of Hotel Zion, which is to say they don't want to have anything to do with the state, and that's a good thing. Now, let me be clear, so there's no room for misapprehension. There are many states which have gone through lunatic phases. I personally do not believe in the notion of original sin, namely, you were born in sin, which Israel was, you know, expelled the indigenous population, but so was the United States. It expelled and exterminated the indigenous population, and also it enslaved the African population. So it's a double sin in the case of the United States. In the case of the U.S., one wrong effectively could not be rectified. The native population was exterminated in large part, and the remnants that remained were confined to reservations. And there's no turning the wheel back on that. In the case of the African Americans, it was a complex, protracted struggle. You will be surprised, I think, to learn. It cost the lives of 700,000 Americans. The Civil War was a very bloody episode in our history. And then it required a second struggle, the Civil Rights Movement, and it will require many more struggles. But I wouldn't describe is American civil life, political life, given who may be president next, and given who's president now, lunatic is still well within a reasonable vocabulary. But in terms of civil life, no, I wouldn't regard the United States as a lunatic state anymore. In the case of Japan and Germany, I would say beginning in the 1930s, obviously not before, Germany was the peak of European civilization. Where do you go to study? You go study in Germany. Where do you go to philosophy? You turn to Germany. Where do you go for literature? You turn to Germany. But beginning, you could say, in the 1930s and climaxing at the end of World, towards the end of World War II, beginning 1943 on, it was a certifiably lunatic state. Same thing with Japan. I mean, people forget, the Japanese killed about 26 million Chinese. Brutal, insane country. So when I describe Israel as a lunatic state, it does not mean to me it's unredeemable. But what's going on now? Starving 1 million children to death? 1 million children to death? That's insane. Sorry. If you lost your capacity to see the innocence of children, you've lost your mind. You're crazy.
I won't
retract that. When Israel's chief historian, Benny Morris, says in a blasé fashion, let's nuke Iran, and then goes on to say, they deserve it. The people, the civilians, he says, because they elected that government. He's their chief historian. He went to Cambridge. He studied in your country. He's actually a good historian, and his English is quite lively. He's got good English prose. He does. Facts are facts. But he's a moral monster. That's a monstrous statement. That's incinerating tens of millions of people. Incinerating. And he doesn't even register, or it doesn't register for him, the moral consequences. He just says, if the United States doesn't join us in the attack on Iran, we'll have to use non-conventional weapons, which is the technical term for nuclear weapons. And he says, if many civilians die, well, they deserved it because they elected that government. That's insane.
How do you think the attacks launched by Iran, which some have argued, it has to be said, were disproportionate in response to the Israeli bombing of the Iranian embassy. But how do you think those attacks and then Israel's sort of airstrike on Friday, how do you think that changes the conflict? Does it make it harder for the West to sort of withdraw support or arms exports, as there was a significant amount of pressure building here in the UK, for example, for that to be the case? Do you think that Iranian involvement, how does it change the dynamic from a Western perspective?
I think you have to understand the context. Israel is premised, or its premise is, it must control and dominate the region. And just a little history, if you'll forgive me. The big threat that Israel was transfixed by after 1948 was his character named Gamal Abdel Nasser, the president of Egypt. And Nasser was, like many Arab nationalists at the time, he was a rabble-rouser. He gave these rousing emotive speeches, and he was what was called a radical Arab nationalist. And the Israelis feared that he would be like Ataturk in Turkey. He would modernize Egypt, and once having modernized Egypt, he would pose a threat to Israel's regional domination. They would have to contend with another power in the region. And Israel did everything they could to topple him. And finally, with the 1967 war, they succeeded. And it was the end of that era, long before you ever emerged from your mother's womb, that era called radical Arab nationalism. And Israel was now sitting pretty in the Middle East. What it didn't anticipate, but nobody anticipated, was a new phenomenon emerged to replace it. Instead of radical Arab nationalism, it was now radical Islamic fundamentalism. And that was Iran, beginning in 1979. And now Israel is as determined to topple the Iranian regime as it was in the 1950s and 60s to topple Egypt, because it does not want to have to reckon with another regional power that hems it in, that doesn't allow it complete freedom to carry on as it wants to carry on. Israel wants to dominate the region. And so my answer to your question, long-winded as I always am, is Israel now has fixed in its crosshairs Iran. And whatever Iran does, if it behaves peacefully, if it behaves passively, if it behaves nonviolently, Israel will keep escalating the provocations until finally it's provoked the final showdown. So we all know Israel killed Iranian scientists. Israel killed all sorts of Iranians over the years, military, civilian, civilian-military overlap, as in nuclear scientists. But my belief now is Israel sees an opportunity in the, because of October 7th and because of the alleged Iranian retaliation, Israel sees an opportunity to finally solve not just the Gaza question by extirpating all the blades of grass from the lawn, but also solving the Hezbollah question and the Iranian question. And one thing you could say about Israelis' leadership, they very rarely let an opportunity pass them by. And they see an opportunity now for a political trifecta: Gaza, Hezbollah, and Iran. So whatever Iran does, Israel will keep escalating, ratcheting up the provocations in order to finally solve that question.
Can we separate out, or I'd invite you actually to separate out between Israel and the leadership there, because I think, or I'd like to know your position on sort of how, I don't want to go around sort of, you know, invoking like the great man of history theory, right? But Netanyahu's capacity and influence and personal motivation in this, because there's, I don't know if this is necessarily the case in the States, but certainly in the UK, a lot of discussion about him personally and his political survival, and that essentially the perpetuation of the war is a necessity for him to stay in office, that once it ends, there'll be elections, he'll be gone, blah, 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 blah. And I wonder how compelling you find that to be. And I'd also actually ask you as well, you know, you've previously spoken about a sort of pragmatic two-state solution. Netanyahu has, you know, expressed opposition to it, sort of any form of Palestinian state now multiple times, since October 7th. So I'd sort of, it, as well as talking about his role and sort of significance of his capacity as an individual, what do you think his actual end game is here? What do you think the outcome that he's pursuing is?
Look, Israel is, for its Jewish component, Israel is a democracy. It is, for its Jewish component. Now, Prime Minister Netanyahu is the longest lasting prime minister in Israeli history. It used to be Ben-Gurion, David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister, but that's, he's been put in the shade, Ben-Gurion, by Netanyahu. If you read the liberal commentators or commentators in the West, there are every few months, they're predicting the end of Netanyahu's rule. It doesn't happen because Netanyahu, he is a reflection and a representation of Israeli society. He's an obnoxious, narcissistic Jewish supremacist who thinks that only Jews count in God's grand design. Everybody else, the goyim, as they're called, they have no place in God's grand design, except where Israel decides to situate or place them. So the first fact is, we have to bear in mind, he remains even now very popular in Israel. The claim is his standing up to Iran has increased his popularity, but as a general rule. Number two, Israel is a democracy. Were it true that his policies were unpopular, another candidate would emerge. That's the nature of a democracy. Have you heard of another candidate who has emerged by dissociating himself or denouncing Netanyahu's policies? The answer is no. Number three, it's not just the Israeli state. If you look at the Israeli society, I'm not talking about the people at the helm of the state. The Israeli society overwhelmingly supports the genocidal war in Gaza. It's about 95% of the Jewish Israelis, 95. I have the statistics right here. Even I have to say, I was a little astonished when I read the latest numbers. Let's see. About 60% of Israeli Jews oppose any humanitarian aid to Gaza. But that's the question of the aid. I'm talking about the war. Let's see. Give me 1.5 seconds. Here, in polls on the issue of the war, on this issue of the war, only 1.8%, that was in October, 7%, that was in December, and 3.2%, that's January, of Jewish Israelis believed the IDF was using too much firepower in Gaza. Do you hear those percentages? As of January, when already it's reaching the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, on charges of genocide, only 3.2% of Jewish Israelis believe the Israeli Defense Forces was using too much firepower in Gaza. So when people want to lay the blame for the insanity on Netanyahu, that is, I don't say it gleefully, I'm simply reporting it objectively. That is a misrepresentation of the facts. If there is no political opposition to be seen against Netanyahu, or substantive, no leader to emerge, it's because the whole population agrees with what Netanyahu is doing. If he were simply doing it, as Western commentators like to say, because the longer the war goes on, the more time it will take for corruption charges to be lodged against him, and so he wants to stay out of jail. If any of that were true, the other Israeli generals and senior officials would simply mount a campaign on those grounds, that he's just trying to protect himself. They're not saying that because they all agree with his policies. We have to be honest about that. They all agree with his policies. That's the problem. It's a lunatic state and a lunatic society. And we should be as free about saying that as we would say about Nazi Germany beginning in around 1943. Now, Nazi Germany, you could say there was extenuating circumstances. What do I mean by that? It was a totalitarian state. It did control all the media. And by 1943, the Germans are clearly beginning to lose the war. And in places like Stalingrad, Leningrad, thousands, if not more than thousands, of German soldiers are freezing to death in the snows, the winter, the Russian winter. And also on the domestic front, there is new privations, deprivations, you know, the restrictions. The German government, because it's losing the war, are putting on consumption and things like that. Okay, and the totalitarian German media, Nazi media, are saying it's all the fault of the Judeo-Bolshevik conspiracy. It's the Judeo-Bolshevik conspiracy, and they're hearing it over and over and over again. So you can understand, I'm not excusing it, I'm just saying factually, you can understand that at some point they've gone crazy and they hate the Jews and the Jews are causing our soldiers to die in the Eastern Front and blah, 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 blah. Israel's not a totalitarian state. Israel probably has the highest usage of the web per capita of any country in the world. Now you could say it's true, the Israeli media are painting a very false picture of what's going on in Gaza. But you know, you're a young man, you know that most young people don't get their information from mainstream media anymore. They get it from the web. Israelis are perfectly aware of what's going on.
Norm, I have to ask you. I don't ask this question because I'm saying that, you know, you haven't evidenced the point that you've just made. You've spent a long time laying out this argument, but you must surely understand that when you make that comparison between the state of Israel and with Nazi Germany, that is an inflammatory thing, right? There are people who will just hear those two things in a sentence and the sort of the moral outrage, the upset at hearing that will be extreme. And I think as well, you know, I think about some of the things that I know you say, right, you don't use the social media, but you send things to people and, you know, they write things and some of the stuff that you, sort of comes out on your social media as well. You know, it is inflammatory. I don't want to retread too much of it because I know you've spoken about it in other media things. You know, I think with Piers Morgan, you had a back and forth about something that you tweeted in relation to October 7th. But I don't tweet, by the way. Yeah, that's what I was saying.
I don't know what tweeting is.
You have someone else who writes it for you,
true.
Right?
Yeah, that's yeah. True.
And I just wonder whether how much of a deliberate choice is it by you to make these points in this fashion, right? To yes, have evidence, talk about the history, to make, you know, compelling, understandable arguments, but nonetheless choose provocation as one of the methods of delivery. How much of that is a deliberate choice by you?
Well, first of all, and this is not an excuse. Again, it's a fact. My parents passed through the Nazi Holocaust. I grew up in that, so to speak, milieu or ambiance, where not a day passed without that experience in some way or other, a bearing on my life growing up. So for me, that's a natural comparison. Number two, it's not as if I have a monopoly on that analogy. If you read Gilad Erdan's speech to the Security Council emergency session last Sunday, it was all about the whole speech. The whole speech was Iran is Nazi Germany, and now Iran wants to conquer the world. Iran is the Third Reich, and Iran needs to be stopped. We need a, as he put it, we need a Churchill, not a Chamberlain now, okay? So it's not as if, as I said, I invented or I plucked from the cobwebbed past this analogy. It's commonplace. Number three, I do think that Israel has now reached a lunatic place where the survival of not just the region, but the planet is at stake. Now, I will recognize there is also that danger looming in Ukraine. The possible escalation, which will take us or hurl us over the precipice. I would make the following distinction, if you will allow me. You're 30 years old, so you probably won't remember much, but there was the second Gulf War, the Iraq War of 2003, okay? Now, in the buildup to the 2003 Iraq War, in no small part presided over your own lunatic prime minister, Tony Blair, with those Dracula eyes. They always looked transfixed, very scary individual, in my opinion. Crazed individual. But what struck me, and I'm going to make a comparison now, one of the crucial steps towards the war in Iraq was the famous speech delivered by our Secretary of State, Colin Powell, at the UN. And in the speech, he laid out the case for attacking Iraq. And he brought to bear all of this, quote unquote, intelligence evidence to prove Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Now, it turned out the evidence was false, but he brought to bear evidence that could be parsed, that's just the fancy word for analyzed, and either affirmed or refuted. It was a rational presentation. Now, remember, the Bush White House was led by Vice President Dick Cheney and Defense Minister Donald Rumsfeld. They were the real forces behind George Bush, who didn't know very much. He was not very bright. And they were right-wing crazies, Cheney and Rumsfeld. They were the ultra-conservative in our country, okay? And yet, they still had the mental lucidity. You have to present a rational argument. But when you read the Israelis now, like Erdogan's speech, I was really struck. Now, you might say, maybe it's because Finkelstein, you're not accustomed to the ways of communicating nowadays, the modes of communication. At one point in his speech, he takes his iPad, Erdogan, the Israeli representative. I'm using my book now. He takes his iPad and it has an image of an Israeli rocket intercepting a drone, an Iranian drone, and it appears to be over Al-Aqsa Mosque. He takes the image and he's holding it up for the whole Security Council. And he pans the Security Council like I'm doing now. And he says, look, we Israelis, we are the protectors of Islamic holy sites. We're protecting the Islamic holy sites from the defilers of the holy sites in Tehran. I'm thinking this guy is a complete nut. I'm wondering, what are people thinking in that Security Council? The guy is a lunatic. Iran wants to take over the world? Yes, Iran wants to be a regional power. I have no doubt about that. Iran's not much different than Brazil or India. It's not China. China wants to be a global power. But there are others that want to be regional powers. Yes, I have no doubt about that. And is it a pretty picture? Actually, I don't think it's a pretty picture. I'm not keen on the Iranian regime. But the Third Reich, Nazi Germany, the Ayatollah is Hitler. They want to take over the world. Do you think Iran wants to take over Fiji?
I'd like to take over Fiji, to be honest with you. They got some nice beaches there.
I'll take over Barbados.
Yeah, good idea. Good idea.
They're crazy.
Norm, you've recently appeared on all kinds of media. Right? I mentioned Piers Morgan then, but you know, you've had debates on his show with the likes of kind of Rabbi Shmuley and Alan Dershowitz. You know, recently you've been on Lex Friedman's podcast. You did that sort of panel debate with the streamer Destiny, but he has another name, but you sort of I think you kept calling him something different. But anyway, you know, you're talking to me now, right? And as an academic that has devoted decades of research,
my whole adult life,
your entire adult life, right, to the Israel-Palestine situation. I mean, how do you prepare yourself to kind of debate with people who are far more politicized and often, to be honest, far less knowledgeable, right, of the situation than you are? You're kind of in this space with people, I'm mainly thinking about Destiny now, who are just frankly unqualified to be engaging with you on the subject matter, and yet you're kind of having to do it, right, to sort of to access the audience and to make these points and to open people up to your research and work, your academia.
First of all, I'm in debt to anyone who gives me a platform. Now, it's not because, as Bernie Sanders used to say, our senator who ran for office, his campaign slogan was, it's not about me, it's about us. So if I'm grateful for the platform, it's not about me. I could say that with absolute certainty. I never sought the limelight. Gaza was not the most popular issue on the block. I invested in it because I felt a duty to record for history, not for the present, what was being done or what had been done to the people of Gaza. When October 7th happened, I was suddenly in demand, but contrary to the optical illusions of the web, I've actually not been in many places at all. You'll be very surprised. Apart from Piers Morgan, who had me on four times, and on all four occasions acquitted himself responsibly and with dignity, in my opinion, I've not been on any of the mainstream media, none. If you were to ask, Have I been on ABC News, NBC News, CBS News? Have I been on CNN, Fox News, MSNBC? Has my name been mentioned in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the New York Review of Books, the New Yorker Magazine, Atlantic Magazine, Los Angeles Times? Answer, no, full stop, no qualifications. What happened is, because of the nature of the web, number one, I get a lot of views, but it's only from a handful of programs. I've not been on Your Hard Talk. Triggerometry, that program, it three times booked me and three times canceled me before I could appear on. Yes, I have the email correspondence. They booked me and then they canceled me. I've not been on almost anywhere, but because I possess a knowledge, not because I was born with the Gaza gene, but because I work hard. And I was the only person to invest my whole mental being in that topic. And as a responsibility, I won't say I possess the truth. I'll say I'm confident I possess a larger portion of the truth than anybody else out there, not because of genius, but because of hard work. So in that sense, it's lives that are at stake. I am very tired right now. I was not prepared for what befell me after October 7th. And I had a whole stack of books on 1,000 different topics that I wanted to read about. And now, once again, I don't want to say burdened, but I have to carry the weight of Gaza. And whenever I feel exhausted, as I often do, I keep telling myself, well, how must the people of Gaza feel after 6.5 months of this horror of fleeing and fleeing and fleeing? If you're in the north, go to the south. And then they go to the south. And then Israel drops these 2,000-pound bombs, these two-ton bombs in Rafah, where they told them to flee. And then they're told to flee here. And then they're given this grid. And they're saying, go to this space in the grid. Go to that space in the grid. You take it like a checkerboard, but multiply it 1,000 times. And that's what these grids that Israel distributes. And they're rushing, and they're rushing, and they're rushing. And in the midst of the rushing, they're being killed. And they have to bury their dead. And then they have to dig up from the rubble those who might still be alive under the rubble. Then they have to go for water, and then they have to go for food, and then they have to go to the convoys, rushing, 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 burying the dead, pulling out the maybe alive. I say, Norm, you live a charmed life, you keep going. So, and I'm grateful for anyone. The thought that always clings to me is everybody clings to their life. Their life. Each of us clings to it. And if you save one life in Gaza, it could be your own. And I cling to my life. So I have no great hopes for what I'm doing, but one life is still something. It might be your own. So I'm grateful to anybody who will have me on, not for me. I'm an old man now. I always say to my friends, you know, if I were 45 and this were happening to me, oh, it's a step on the career ladder, even though it's a sick step, sick. Because what is it? I'm only a known quantity now because people are dying in droves. That's the only reason I'm a known quantity. If people were happy in Gaza, nobody would give a damn about me, my book, my knowledge, or anything else. So I have to always maintain the self-possession of remembering, if I'm now a known quantity, it's because thousands, and they're now saying tens of thousands, of Palestinians are going to die in this man-made famine. It would be a sin against the memory of what happened to my parents, were I to take pride in the position I'm in now. When my mother, for example, talked about the war, she didn't talk about the barbarities, and she never talked about her family. I have no idea what happened to my mother's family. Every member was exterminated. I have no idea what happened to my father's family. Every member exterminated. But my mother always talked about the hunger, the hunger, the hunger in the ghetto in particular, in the Warsaw ghetto, the hunger. And so for me now to take pride in my, in the fact that I was on Piers Morgan four times, no, that would be a sin against the horrors that my parents endured. And the second thing is, I'm an old man. My life is behind me. It's not an item now for my resume. It's not going to get me a plum position. All my friends are retired. So I don't have, so to speak, a professional dog in this race. I don't. Sometimes when I get a little, you know, I get a little carried away with myself. I do. My mother used to, whenever I got carried away with myself, she used the expression, clip my wings, to remind me, Norman, don't get carried away with yourself, you know? And whenever I get carried away, I say, Norm, you have like 15 years left to live. This is not a feather in your cap. So I'm glad to be there. If I can save that one life, could be my own. And I do believe I know more, only because of hard work, no genes. I was very close friends for 40 years with Professor Chomsky. He was my mentor. And I think it's fair to say I was his disciple and protege, not his only disciple and protege, but one among several. That's correct. But I was in his physical presence for 40 years. I know genius. I do. I know genius. I'm not by a wide margin, but I work hard. I always work hard. And I'm responsible for people dying, and by some strange turn of fate, I found myself in this strange position that all of a sudden I was the world's leading authority on this subject. It could have been the South Sahara. It could have been the Kurds. It could have been East Timor. It could have been a thousand different places. But I turned out to be the world's leading authority on this tiny, tiny little place, which is actually in population smaller than Brooklyn, New York, where I live. And I happen to know, in terms of the detail, the documentary detail, not the physical topography, But in documentary detail, I just happen to know more than anybody else, and I'm going to use it. I'm going to battle on, and do what I can to reveal, to expose, not what happened on October 7th and thereafter, because there's a lot of good material out there now. Those UN agencies have documented from beginning October 8th, the horrors that were inflicted. So I'm really unnecessary for that. If you look at the South African's application to the International Court of Justice, it's 84 single-spaced pages with hundreds and hundreds of footnotes from the UN agencies. So I'm not needed there. But I know what happened before October 7th, you know? I know what happened to the battered woman for 20 years because I was the next door neighbor. Before she killed her spouse, I know what brought her to that point. I heard the screams. I heard the banging. I saw how physically battered she was. So when I heard that she killed her husband and she stabbed him 100 times and all of the tabloids had as the headlines, monster woman stabs husband 100 times, I know what preceded those 100 stabbings.
Norm, thank you for your, well, thank you for being the leading authority in the field of one, as you put it, when we started our conversation.
That's absolutely true.
And thank you for your hard work, and thank you for speaking to me now. It means a great deal, and I think your words mean a great deal to a lot of people. So thank you very much, and I wish you all the best. Is there anything you'd like to, any resources or otherwise you'd like to point people towards before we finish this conversation, or anything you'd like them to go and take a look at?
A good young Brit, Jamie Sternweiner, just published a book called Deluge. He's the editor of a book called Deluge on what has happened in Gaza in the last 6 months, and also the background. And it's put out by Orr Books, and it's a solid volume. I don't have a contribution in it, so I'm not tooting my own horn. I'm saying it's a solid book, and it gives the requisite, the necessary background. So I would definitely recommend it.
Norm, thank you again for your time. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.